purpose in the current circus. If you're seeking respect and attention, if you're in need of a gig that'll make you fit.
An ICE officer shot and killed a woman in Minneapolis today.
That much is not in dispute, but Minnesota officials are pushing back against the federal account of what happened and why.
We'll question a U.S. senator from Minnesota this Wednesday, January 7th, on All Things Considered. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. Ahead this hour, Marco Rubio already wears plenty of hats.
He's the Secretary of State, the National Security Advisor. Is he now also taking on the job of running Venezuela?
There's nobody that Trump relies on more right now than Marco Rubio to execute his policy.
Plus, why U.S. investors have largely welcomed President Trump's military action in Venezuela.
There are much, much greater upsides in the bond market than what investors went to sleep thinking they were on Friday.
After the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Ryland Barton. An immigration officer shot and killed a woman in her car during the Trump administration's immigration action in Minneapolis. Federal officials say the shooting was an act of self-defense. Minnesota Democratic Governor Tim Walz says he's been warning for weeks that someone would be hurt during the crackdown.
We do not need any further help from the federal government. To Donald Trump and Kristi Noem, you've done enough. There's nothing more important than Minnesotan safety. I've issued a warning order to prepare the Minnesota National Guard. We have soldiers in training and prepared to be deployed if necessary.
President Trump is defending the ICE officer who killed the woman, blaming what he called the radical left for the incident. In a social media post, Trump said ICE agents are, quote, just trying to do the job of making America safe. The FBI and Minnesota state authorities are investigating. Russia is accusing the U.S. of violating the law of the sea with its seizure of a Russian-flagged oil tanker with ties to Venezuela. U.S. forces boarded the ship in the North Atlantic, saying it was in violation of U.S. sanctions on Venezuelan oil exports. From Moscow, Charles Maines has details.
In a statement, Russia's transport ministry says the vessel had received temporary permission to sail under the Russian flag back in late December. Russia lost contact with the vessel after, according to Moscow, U.S. naval forces boarded the ship in violation of freedom of navigation principles laid out in the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea. Separately, Russia's foreign ministry is calling for the safe return of Russian nationals on board. The U.S. had been in pursuit of the tanker for nearly 2 weeks on suspicion it was carrying sanctioned Venezuelan oil. Charles Maines, NPR News, Moscow.
Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. has announced new dietary guidelines for Americans focused on promoting whole foods, healthy proteins, and fats. NPR's Allison Aubrey reports the administration has unveiled a new food pyramid with red meat, vegetables, and fruits pictured at the top.
Secretary Kennedy described the new guidelines as the most significant reset on nutrition policy in history, calling for an end to policies that promote highly refined foods that are harmful to health. The guidelines will set limits on added sugars and encourage diets that include meat and dairy.
Protein and healthy fats are essential and were wrongly discouraged in prior dietary guidelines. We are ending the war on saturated fats.
The guidelines are highly influential, determining what's served in school meals and on military bases, as well as what's included in federal food aid. Allison Aubrey, NPR News.
A judge has delayed Nick Reiner's arraignment in the killing of his parents, director Rob Reiner and Michelle Singer Reiner. His attorney asked to be replaced by a public defender. He did not say why. It's been more than 3 weeks since the Reiners were found stabbed to death. Wall Street's strong start to the year slowed today. The S&P 500 slipped 0.3%. It's NPR. New York City Mayor Zoran Mamdani is supporting a new housing official amid backlash over past social media posts. Tenant activist Sia Weaver was appointed last week. Her old posts called for the seizure of private property and linked homeownership to white supremacy. Weaver expressed regret, saying the remarks are, quote, not something I would say today. Fighting in Yemen is escalating after separatists took over huge swaths of the country from Saudi-backed fighters. Talks between the factions were meant to take place this week, but the leader of the southern fighters' whereabouts are unknown. NPR's Ayo Batraoui reports the group wants to secede from the north of Yemen, where Iranian-backed Houthis hold sway.
Efforts to de-escalate the recent fighting have not succeeded. Saudi-backed forces are pushing south to win back territory from the Southern Transitional Council, or STC, which says the Saudi Air Force is also carrying out deadly airstrikes. Saudi Arabia says it carried out, quote, preemptive strikes in the south of Yemen to curtail the STC. Meanwhile, the whereabouts of the head of the STC are unclear. A Saudi spokesperson says Idris al-Zubaydi fled to an unknown location after failing to board a flight to the kingdom for talks. This comes the same day that Yemen's presidential council ousted the secessionist leader as a member and referred him to prosecution for treason. The STC says al-Zubaydi remains in the southern Yemeni city of Aden, overseeing military and civilian affairs. Aya Boltraoui, NPR News, Dubai.
A winter storm system brought snow, ice, freezing rain, and dangerous driving to New England, and the region's preparing for more unpleasant conditions later in the week. The combination of rain, snow, and slush have blanketed roads and caused dozens of school districts to close. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Lilly Endowment, a private foundation supporting NPR's coverage of religion and spirituality, and Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts.
It is 4:06. Thank you for listening to KAXE and All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. Support comes from Bridget's Pub in downtown Bemidji, serving Irish and American food, offering Monday night trivia at 6:30 and open mic night on Thursday, starting at 6:30. More on Facebook. Areas of fog overnight, mostly cloudy, lows near 24, and tomorrow partly sunny with highs near 34. Looking ahead to Friday, mostly cloudy, highs near 29. More news is next.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. A 37-year-old woman was shot dead by an ICE agent today in Minneapolis. She was not the target of immigration enforcement. That's according to local police. But the circumstances around the shooting are hotly disputed. Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem said the woman attacked federal immigration officers and attempted to ram them with her vehicle. A DHS statement says an ICE officer feared for his life and for public safety and fired defensive shots. Now, there is bystander video of the event. Democratic politicians from Minnesota who have seen that video strongly contradict this account. Democratic Governor Tim Walz called the federal government's claims propaganda. Minneapolis Mayor Jacob Frey says it was an agent recklessly using power and used several expletives to underscore his disgust. We've now reached U.S. Senator Tina Smith of Minnesota. She's also a Democrat. Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much. I'm sorry to be with you under these circumstances, but so glad to talk with you.
Very much the same. Senator, you wrote on social media that Homeland Security's description of what's happened in your state does not match up with the video. Let's just start by talking about it. What did you take away from what you saw?
Well, I mean, first I start from this 37-year-old woman, Renee Nicole Good, who's lost her life. She was in her car in a neighborhood that is only a few miles from where I live in Minneapolis. Mm-hmm. And it's inconceivable and so reckless that that Secretary Noem, within just minutes or hours of this terrible shooting, would go out and say exactly what she thinks happened. And this is why we have investigations in situations like this. And I'm glad that the Federal Bureau of Investigation mm-hmm. and the Criminal Investigation Unit in the state of Minnesota will be looking into this. But I can tell you that what I saw on those bystander videos is nothing like what Secretary Noem or President Trump, for that matter, described. And it just further challenges people's trust and in these institutions, these federal institutions and this administration. I can tell you in my home state of Minnesota, people are just racked with grief and mm-hmm. anger and fear, and it's a very bad moment.
And I want to just jump in here and put out there what President Trump's view is on this. On social media, yeah. He called this woman a professional agitator. He said the woman was acting, and these are his words, very disorderly, obstructing and resisting. How do you respond?
Well, there's nothing that I have seen that would suggest that that's the case. I'm waiting for them to show us what that really means. Mm-hmm. This is a woman who was in her car on a neighborhood street in Minneapolis. And what I saw are these ICE agents who appeared to be engaged in escalating a situation rather than de-escalating a situation. There's been a lot of question about the training of these individuals and what do they actually know about the communities that they are going into. And what I have seen suggests that they were reckless and they were escalating a situation and making it more dangerous. And certainly it's because of them that this woman lost her life.
I just want to back up for a second here. The Trump administration had already been deploying as many as 2,000 federal immigration agents to the city of Minneapolis this week. I am sure that you heard, as we all have, Mayor Fry demanding that ICE leave the city, the state, immediately. Senator, do you see any role for immigration agents to play in your state?
Well, of course, there's a role for federal immigration in our country and in our state. But what is happening here is outside of the bounds of how immigration should work. They are going willy-nilly into neighborhoods. They are terrorizing communities. They are failing completely to coordinate with local law enforcement. So, for example, violent and ultimately fatal incident in a otherwise quiet neighborhood in Minneapolis, the local law enforcement had no idea that those ICE agents were even there. And so what I see is that these agents are contributing to worsening public safety in my community rather than improving public safety. And I agree. I think that Mayor Fry had it exactly right. They should leave. They should get out of there. They are not helping us to keep my community safe.
And your state's Governor Walz said that he could soon mobilize the state's National Guard in response to the shooting. What has happened there today? Do you agree?
Well, we have so many painful memories of the aftermath of the murder of George Floyd, and I believe that the governor and the mayor are correct to be prepared. I, of course, fully support my neighbors' rights to speak out and to demonstrate against what they've seen, and that needs to happen in a peaceful way, and I think it's important that we protect people's safety as that will, I think, inevitably unfold over the coming days.
We have just about 30 seconds left, so I want to end with this. Do you know where the investigation goes from here, and do you have confidence it will be handled impartially and fairly?
It is hard to have trust in a federal investigation when the secretary has already described to everybody what she thinks happened. That suggests that she is already completely biased. I'm grateful, though, for the local law enforcement, the local FBI agents on the ground in Minneapolis who I have trust in, and, of course, the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension in Minnesota.
Minnesota Senator Tina Smith, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
You might think Marco Rubio already has a lot on his plate, what with being President Trump's Secretary of State and Trump's National Security Advisor. Is Rubio now adding to his portfolio governing the country of Venezuela? Now, there is a lot we do not know about what comes next in that country. We do know Rubio is playing a central role now that Nicolas Maduro has been ousted as president. John Hudson covers Secretary Rubio as National Security Reporter for the Washington Post. He's with me now. Hey there.
Hey, good to be with you.
So you had a story the other day headlined, and I quote, "Rubio takes on most challenging role yet, Viceroy of Venezuela." Viceroy, is that overstating the role we expect to see Rubio stepping up to play?
Well, it is a bit of a cheeky application of a colonial era term, but it does really represent the outsized role and influence that Rubio has in the administration over all Venezuela policy. And it also conveys the importance that the United States has right now in terms of influencing the state of affairs in Venezuela. And there's nobody that Trump relies on more right now than Marco Rubio to execute his policy.
Rubio's parents are Cuban. They left Cuba in the 1950s. That was before the rise of Fidel Castro and his whole communist government. Do we know how that informs his perspective in terms of what he would like to see play out in the region?
Yes, I think that the road to understanding Marco Rubio's views on Venezuela, Rubio, a Cuban-American who came up in Republican Florida politics, that's a place where anti-Castro, anti-Cuban regime sentiment is in the DNA of almost all Republican Florida politicians. And so ever since Rubio has been a politician, he has been calling for regime change in Cuba. And for many Cuba watchers, they have long felt that because of the historic ties between the Venezuelan regime and the Cuban regime, if the Venezuelan domino falls, then the Cuban domino could fall as well. And so those have been the chief adversaries of a lot of the Cuba hawks in the United States.
So to focus us on this moment, President Trump says the U.S. is running Venezuela for the foreseeable future. Rubio has sounded a little more hands-on off. I want to play, this is a little bit of Rubio speaking. This was an interview on ABC News.
What we are running is the direction that this is going to move moving forward. And that is, we have leverage. This leverage we are using and we intend to use. We started using already.
So he was talking about economic leverage. But the president says the U.S. is running Venezuela. Rubio saying what we're running is the direction this is moving. Is there daylight between the president and his secretary of state on the way forward?
Well, there's certainly rhetorical daylight. After the president said that the United States would be running Venezuela, there were tons of questions, a lot of confusion. It has been Rubio's job to articulate what that means. And what we're finding out is that what it means is the United States is not installing new leadership. It is not putting Americans in formal positions of the Venezuelan government. What it is doing is attempting to dictate the policies of the Venezuelan government through the art of coercion and the threat of violence.
So do we know, has Rubio articulated what he would consider success in Venezuela? Do we know for Rubio what the end game is?
I think we do. And again, what he articulates has some rhetorical daylight between what the president articulates. Rubio has had a more expansive goal for what he has talked about when it comes to Venezuela. He said, you know, they're no longer going to be in cahoots with governments that the United States doesn't like. But Trump has been much more narrowly focused. He has said, we're getting the oil and we also want to stem the flow of immigration.
Last thing, John Hudson, for those who may be wondering, when on earth Marco Rubio is going to find time to sleep? How is it possible to do all of these jobs? How on earth does one person juggle it?
I mean, it's a great question. Rubio is wearing a ton of hats right now. And I have talked to government officials, including Republicans in the current State Department, who have said, look, this is a extremely taxing job. When it comes to exerting influence over Venezuela and devising U.S. policy on Venezuela, there are so many decisions. People have said that the administration really should appoint an envoy or appoint person who can be in charge of these things. Rubio, given his job as the top diplomat and the National Security Advisor, he's going to be stretched very thin. But, of course, this is the moment that Rubio has pushed for his entire life. He's been seeking change in Venezuela. And so one can expect him to be very focused on this, as focused as much as he can, because this is truly what he's been building up to his entire life.
John Hudson, national security reporter at The Washington Post. Thank you.
Great to be with you.
Listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
You are listening to All Things Considered on People Powered KAXC. Thanks so much for tuning in. It is 4:18. I'm Jennifer Barr. In just a few moments, our daily dose of phonology with John Latimer. He's talking about snow fleas today. The classic movie series continues at the Edge Center for the Arts in Big Fork tomorrow evening, 6:30. Showing is Spellbound, directed by Alfred Hitchcock and starring Ingrid Bergman and Gregory Peck. Here's John Latimer.
On today's date, January 7th, 2008, the surface of the snow is littered with snow fleas. Snow fleas belong to a family called springtails. They get their name from a tail-like appendage called the furcula, which they tuck up underneath their bodies. They grasp that furcula with a hook called a retinaculum. And the retinaculum holds the tail, the spring tail, in place until the snow fleas wants to move. And then it simply releases the retinaculum, and 18 milliseconds later, they're gone. And they fling themselves away from danger and end up in a new spot, unpredicted by them and by you, because they really don't know which way they're headed when they release that furcula. An interesting thing about the snow fleas is that they can reduce their body size by 30% as temperatures warm. And that seems a little counterintuitive, but because they use less energy as a smaller animal, they can get by with less food. And that is to their advantage in the summertime. So as the temperature warms, they get smaller.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Wallace Foundation, an independent nonpartisan research foundation collaborating with grantees and partners in the arts, school leadership, and youth development. More at wallacefoundation.org. From Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. At WTGrantFDN.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. Wall Street traditionally hates uncertainty, like the kind that often comes with major geopolitical volatility. But so far, investors have largely welcomed President Trump's military action in Venezuela. U.S. stock markets have hit record highs, and some investors are especially excited about Trump's promise that the U.S. will take over oil production. NPR financial correspondent Maria Aspen is here to tell us more. Hi.
Hey there.
So, Maria, President Trump is framing this as a really big win for U.S. oil companies. Do investors agree?
Overall, yes. Oil companies like Chevron, in particular, had a great day on Monday. Shares have fallen back since, but there's still a lot of optimism in the energy industry. You see that also among investors in companies that provide services to the oil industry, like Halliburton. Today was more mixed in the stock market, but overall, Wall Street had a great start to the week. Some of that's not related to Venezuela, like the ongoing tech boom, but some of it is.
Like what?
Well, it was a great week for bonds, and specifically holders of Venezuelan government debt. Back in 2017, now ousted President Nicolas Maduro, his government defaulted on its debt, meaning that Venezuela stopped making payments. That left foreign investors, including some big U.S. financial institutions, holding tens of billions of dollars in debt, which seemed kind of worthless. But then this weekend, everything changed. I talked about this with Eric Fine. He's a longtime bond investor and the emerging markets portfolio manager at the investment firm VanEck.
We're in a different ballpark now, and there are much, much greater upsides in the bond market than what investors went to sleep thinking they were on Friday.
He says investors are betting that the U.S. takeover will be good for the oil industry, the Venezuelan economy, and even eventually, depending on what happens with the Venezuelan government, its ability to make good on those debts.
Maria, who else on Wall Street seems to be benefiting from everything happening in Venezuela?
Well, companies that make weapons and other defense contractors, like Lockheed Martin, Boeing, General Dynamics, they all had a pretty great start to the week in the stock market. I mean, stepping back, Juana, the Venezuela strike reinforced that President Trump is very willing to take military action. Obviously, in general, that raises a lot of controversy, but specifically for investors in the companies that supply the military, business could be booming. More broadly, it also shows the more mixed reaction that investors have to geopolitical instability these days. They don't like it on paper, but in practice, they're shrugging it off.
Maria, why aren't investors more worried about the Venezuelan situation and geopolitical instability?
Some of it is what you and I have discussed a lot on the show about the tech boom and the artificial intelligence frenzy that's powering so much of the stock market. They're just focused on other things. There are some signs of worry if you look. For example, the price of silver hit a record high earlier this week. Gold prices are up. And precious metals in general are a hedge in times of uncertainty. So even though Wall Street does seem largely optimistic this week, there are signs that some investors are still hedging their bets.
NPR's Maria Aspen, thank you.
Thank you.
Every January, everyone who is anyone in the world of technology shows up in Las Vegas for one of the biggest industry expos on the planet, CES, also known as the Consumer Electronics Show. It's the equivalent of 10 or 12 city blocks worth of companies showcasing their newest gadgets, from smart Lego bricks to tech-enabled diapers. NPR tech correspondent John Ruwich is there. He's on the line. Hi, John.
Hey there.
Hey there. So smart Legos and tech diapers. I did not have this on my bingo card to say on air today. Tell me more.
Yeah, there's so much crazy and interesting stuff like that here, and lots of people. You can hear them in the background. So Lego introduced interactive bricks at the show. They have chips in them. They make sounds and light up. And yes, there will be Star Wars sets. Mm-hmm. And a Japanese company I came across had a smart diaper on display. It's a healthcare product for older people. It uses sensors to track how much fluid the diaper has absorbed, and it uses that fluid to power the sensors. Those are just two examples of literally tens of thousands of things that are on display here. I saw gigantic and super thin new TVs, less than a centimeter thick, a drone with machine guns on, designed, of course, for the defense industry, wearable exoskeletons to help you walk, and a South Korean company is developing a robot to fix divots on golf courses.
Of course it is. As a parent, I will say the smart Legos sound like a nightmare. But anyway, wait, tell me, are you seeing any trends among all these gadgets?
Yeah, there's a few things that have really stood out to me. First, it really struck me how much AI is being folded into products that are in the consumer pipeline. So artificial intelligence, as consumers know it, really seems poised to be expanding in a big way, from chatbots and AI on your laptop to AI in physical objects that you might use. Think AI-enabled wearables like smart glasses, wristbands, rings. There are also products that are meant to make AI a part of your regular life. The healthcare company Abbott Laboratories launched a product for diabetics here. Sunny Nagra, a director of products at the company, showed it to me. He used their app to take a picture of a fake plate of spaghetti.
So it's analyzing that photo, it's breaking it down, it's doing a prediction of the impact it'll have on your glucose. But what's also really cool is the AI world will turn helpful tips.
So helpful AI-enabled tips to help you keep your glucose in check.
Okay, so that seems in line with the broader trend of all the buzz in tech about AI. Were there big announcements related to AI?
Yeah, Intel, which the government took a stake in last year, announced that they're now selling a new cutting-edge AI chip for PCs. Analysts I spoke to said this is a milestone in its potential comeback story. AMD and NVIDIA, both giants in the world of AI processors, announced new AI chips. And for NVIDIA, actually, this timing is interesting. The company usually makes these kind of major, you know, unveiling announcements during its annual developer conference, which is less than 3 months away. CEO Jensen Huang said the company's production cadence is accelerating. NVIDIA is now aiming for annual upgrades. And at a press conference yesterday, he said it has to.
Otherwise, you stay static for 2 years, 3 years, 4 years. That's really too long, considering how quickly the technology is moving.
NVIDIA has been one of the hottest companies on Earth over the past couple of years. Its share price has soared, and it's under a lot of pressure to perform.
All right, so what else do you think we might be seeing more of in the near future?
The robots are coming for us, Mary Louise. The companies that I saw seemed to draw crowds around their robots had their robots doing like human tasks, very precise things. A Singapore-based company called Sharpa that I saw had robots with really sensitive, dexterous, human-like hands. Mm-hmm. So one of these robots was handling a Polaroid camera and snapping pictures of people. One was playing ping pong. Another was folding paper into pinwheels. And the one that got the most attention, perhaps unsurprisingly here in Las Vegas, was dealing blackjack.
Love it. NPR's John Ruwich with the latest from CES in Las Vegas. Thank you, John.
You are welcome.
Support for All Tech Considered comes from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort, offering small ship experiences with a shore excursion included in every port and programs designed for cultural enrichment. Learn more at viking.com.
This is NPR News.
It's 4:29. You're listening to KAXE and All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. In just a few moments, national native news. And 1 hour from now, it's the Up North Report, local news from our region. Support for KAXE comes from Grand Itasca Clinic and Hospital, home to an experienced OBGYN team that provides comprehensive women's health services, including maternity and advanced gynecology care, all in Grand Rapids. Learn more at granditasca.org. Areas of fog overnight, mostly cloudy, lows near 24, patchy fog early tomorrow morning, then partly sunny, highs near 34, winds from the west 5 to 10. Lows tomorrow night in the low teens, and for Friday, mostly cloudy, highs near 29. The exhibit Minwa Jimawin, Good Stories, opens at the Watermark Art Center this Friday, highlighting community members who have served in the Nedawash communities for many years. A reception for the exhibit is coming up on February 14th.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Last November, a stranded humpback whale near Yahats had to be euthanized after rescue efforts to put the 10-ton, 28-foot-long mammal back into the ocean failed. As Brian Bull of Buffalo's Fire reports, what followed became a meaningful collaboration between the Confederated Tribes of Tsleil-Waututh Indians and a team from Oregon State University.
In mid-November, volunteers worked around the clock to keep the whale doused in seawater and to try pulling it back into the sea. Video from the Oregonian captured some of those harried efforts. Finally, on-site stranding experts and veterinarians agreed to put the whale down. A necropsy team from OSU prepared to remove samples to determine how the whale lived before getting tangled in crab pot line. Kurt Williams is the director of the Oregon Veterinary Diagnostic Lab.
I've never done a necropsy exam on a whale before. I don't think I'll have another opportunity. I hope I don't have another opportunity because I don't want this to happen to these animals.
Another group of roughly 20 Tsleil-Waututh tribal members also came. Among them was Lisa Norton, chief administrative officer for the tribe. She said they began by laying down tobacco and praying with Williams' team.
We offer up prayers for the animal and the bounty it's going to give us. People kind of did their own thing. They prayed in whatever way was comfortable for them, but we just spent some time taking in the enormity of the task.
There's been a historic tension between tribes and scholars, often due to academic institutions pillaging remains and artifacts from native burial mounds and village sites. But these two groups, standing side by side with the whale, worked in tandem, conferring with each other as they worked against the incoming tide and pending sunset. Again, Lisa Norton and Kurt Williams.
We were able to get them to get more specimens than they would have otherwise. And that resulted in them finishing quicker and getting more samples had they just done it on their own, but also allowed us to preserve more parts of the whale for future use.
Being able to work alongside the members of the Tsleil-Waututh tribe was amazing.
The Tsleil-Waututh have stored 1,500 pounds of blubber for possible soap or oil, while the whale's skeleton has been buried for possible use later as a museum piece. While the whale's death was a sad event for many, the collaboration between the tribe and university gave a primer for how to handle similar incidents in the future. Angela Sandana is the Natural Resources Director for the Tsleil-Waututh.
We would anticipate that if something similar happened, that we would revive those relationships and collaborations that we've built from this experience.
For National Native News, I'm Brian Bull.
The Indian Health Service, or IHS, recently announced 7 projects to build or renovate healthcare facilities, often in rural areas throughout Indian country. As KJZZ's Gabriel Piatrazio reports, one of those beneficiaries will be Arizona's Akchen Indian community.
The tribe's chairman, Gabriel Lopez, is grateful.
Currently, we have a satellite facility, which is 2,000 square feet. It's a triple white trailer with minimal services.
Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. met with the Akchen Indian community in November. After that visit, he made a social media post with Lopez.
The elders in the community have to drive 60 to 80 miles to get decent care, and they have to go through Maricopa County with all the traffic. So it's an inconvenience, and it can be a lethal inconvenience.
Akchen will construct a 60,000-square-foot facility and lease it at no cost to IHS for 2 decades. In exchange, the agency will lobby Congress on behalf of the tribe for federal funding to staff and maintain the building.
In a roundabout way, we're looking at maybe about 2 years to be up and running.
I'm Gabriel Piatrazio.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support for law and justice-related programming provided by Hobbs, Strauss, Dean & Walker, LLP, a national law firm dedicated to promoting and defending tribal rights for over 40 years. More information available at HobbsStrauss.com.
Tribal Development Partners, helping tribes build toward their goals through 105L leasing and essential facility development. Empowering sovereignty, strengthening community. More at TribalDevPartners.com. Proud supporters of this show.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from your part-time controller, specializing in nonprofit accounting and committed to supporting nonprofits with financial management services such as budgeting and forecasting. yptc.com/NPR. From Americans United for Separation of Church and State, since 1946, AU has supported the First Amendment right of freedom of religion. More at au.org. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. Around 2 weeks ago, U.S. ships tried to stop an oil tanker in the Caribbean, but the tanker refused to cooperate, changing course and heading out into the Atlantic. U.S. forces finally seized the ship today as it was sailing with a Russian flag in the North Atlantic between Britain and Iceland. This is a very strange tale with many twists and turns. And NPR national security correspondent Greg Myrie is here in the studio to help unravel some of them. Hello.
Hey, Juana.
All right, Greg, let's just cut to the chase. Tell us how this started.
Yeah, so we know the U.S. started seizing these sanctioned oil tankers a month ago, part of the ghost fleet of these shady private operators worldwide who transport sanctioned oil from Venezuela, Russia, Iran. So two ships were seized in the Caribbean, no big deal. Then the U.S. forces tried to stop and seize another one in late December called the Bella One. It was believed to be heading to Venezuela to pick up oil, but the Bella One refused to stop. It changed course and headed out to the Atlantic and then toward Northern Europe, and the U.S. forces were pursuing it. Now, along the way, the Bella One changed its name. The crew painted a new name on the hull of the ship, the Marinera. It also changed flags from the flag of Guyana into the flag of Russia, all while the U.S. forces are chasing it.
Interesting. Okay, so how did this culminate today?
Well, this nautical makeover did not deter the U.S. forces. According to a U.S. official, the troops boarded the ship in the North Atlantic, north of Britain and south of Iceland, several thousand miles from where this all began. Now, the U.S. officials say the ship and the crew are now being brought to the U.S. Many critics are saying the Trump administration is carrying out these dramatic actions, but doesn't really have a strategy for dealing with Venezuela. Secretary of State Marco Rubio responded today.
We don't want it descending into chaos. Part of that stabilization, and the reason why we understand and believe that we have the strongest leverage possible, is our quarantine.
So the U.S. is now controlling the flow of Venezuela's oil, and it expects to get up to 50 million barrels from the country.
We're going to sell it in the marketplace at market rates, not at the discounts Venezuela was getting. That money will then be handled in such a way that we will control how it is dispersed in a way that benefits the Venezuelan people.
So President Trump has also talked about this, and the details are still emerging.
What have we heard, if anything, from the Russians?
Well, the Russian Transportation Ministry said it gave the ship temporary permission to fly the Russian flag on December 24th. It added that, quote, freedom of navigation rules operate in the open sea, and no government has the right to use force against ships. So clear Russian opposition, but in a formal, measured way, Russia isn't making any threats or talking about retaliation.
Here's a question I have. Why would Russia allow this tanker to fly its flag?
Yeah, Russia hasn't given a clear answer. It is possible Russia thought this might deter the U.S. from seizing the ship. Russia is an ally of Venezuela, but didn't really do much to prevent this U.S. campaign. So perhaps it thought allowing a tanker to fly its flag was a low-cost way of assisting Venezuela.
Stepping back a second, how does this U.S. move fit with its larger operation against Venezuela?
So with former President Nicolas Maduro now in U.S. custody, the campaign is increasingly focused on Venezuela's oil. The U.S. actually seized a second oil tanker today, the Sofia, in the Caribbean. The U.S. says this is also a sanctioned tanker. President Trump is expected to talk with U.S. oil companies on Friday. He wants them to go into Venezuela as soon as possible.
NPR's Greg Myrie, thank you.
Sure thing, Juana.
Okay, as we just heard, deposed President Nicolas Maduro is in U.S. custody, sitting in a New York jail, but the rest of his repressive government remains in power back at home. Maduro's former vice president has been sworn in as the country's interim leader. Two powerful ministers who run the intelligence services and the military are firmly in command. It's unclear how much will change under this new, very much same as the old, leadership. NPR's Carrie Kahn reports from Bogota, Colombia.
Under a steady rain, Kelidiana Matasadeño rushes out of the Venezuelan embassy in Bogota. Like the nearly 3 million migrants now living in Colombia, she's eager to go home and had a quick message for President Trump.
Gracias y que bueno que haga lo que tenga que hacer.
Thank you, and go ahead and do whatever you have to do, she said. But she added,
tienen que sacar el régimen para poder regresarnos todos.
They have to get rid of the regime, she says, if we are all going to be able to go back home. That doesn't look like it's going to happen anytime soon. On the ground this week, armed paramilitary gangs, or colectivos, as well as uniformed officers, were out in full force on Caracas streets.
Leales siempre!
Longtime Interior Minister Diosdado Cabello, who heads the police and feared security forces, has been joining the patrols and posting multiple videos like this one since the U.S. attack. Flanked in heavily armed forces in fatigues, the group alternates shouting loyalty forever and Cabello's trademark slogan, to doubt is treason. He's a staunch defender of the regime and a frequent participant in pro-government rallies like this one yesterday. They kidnapped Nicolás and thought the revolution would fall, but they don't know us, he told the crowd. Nicolás, we will get you back, he said to great applause. And we raise our voices against American imperialism, he added. Cabello has been a key enforcer of the regime and is named in the indictment charging Maduro and his wife with drug trafficking. He denies the charges. His key ally and powerful defense minister, Vladimir Padrino, remains in his post too. Padrino has also been under U.S. sanctions. He refutes any wrongdoing too. And both men remain staunchly by interim president Delcy Rodriguez's side.
Aquí está el alto mando.
Like at this televised cabinet meeting after she was sworn in, pointing to both men, Venezuela's high command, in a demonstration of continuity. Her rise through the ranks of Venezuela's hardline leftist core has been steady and pragmatic, says Francisco Rodriguez, an economist at the University of Denver. She took over running much of the oil industry and the economy, he says, after corruption scandals and mismanagement nearly tanked the country a decade ago.
Things have improved under her watch, definitely.
She is known as a pragmatist who gets things done, he says. She understood the government had to foster better relations with the business community, oil executives, and Wall Street, despite their vast ideological differences.
And in that sense, she was very different from other economics ministers who had had a different view in which the private sector didn't matter.
But now having to manage the hardliners still in power while also appeasing Trump will be her biggest challenge, says Juan Gonzalez, President Biden's former National Security Council advisor.
What is the least that she can give to Trump while making him happy so that she is not in this position where she's viewed as giving away all of Venezuela's resources to the United States?
She's already confronted that challenge after Trump threatened her with a fate worse than Maduro's if she didn't fall in line. To that, she responded,
"Quienes me amenacen, lo digo.
To those who threaten me, my destiny is not determined by them, but by God." Carrie Kahn, NPR News, Bogota, Colombia.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Online influencers who support President Trump are taking a victory lap. It comes after a viral video alleging widespread fraud in Minnesota daycare centers had swift policy and political repercussions. Now they're flooding social media platforms with new unverified allegations of fraud in other states. NPR's Jude Joffe Block is here with more. Hi.
Hello.
Jude, break it down for us. What exactly are all of these influencers celebrating?
Well, yeah, right after Christmas, YouTuber Nick Shirley posted a video from Minnesota alleging that certain daycares and businesses there operated by people of Somali descent got public funds without delivering services. And those specific claims have not been proven at this point. Nevertheless, the Trump administration is taking a lot of action. It's freezing federal funds for child care subsidies in Minnesota and four other Democratic-run states. It's changing other child care funding procedures nationwide. 2,000 federal agents are now on the ground in Minnesota for immigration enforcement, and tensions are escalating there. A woman was fatally shot by an ICE agent today. On Monday, the state's governor and the former Democratic vice presidential candidate, Tim Walz, announced he'll no longer run for a third term. After that announcement, Trump-aligned influencers gloated, with Nick Shirley posting to X, "I ended Tim Walz."
What does all of this tell us about the relationship between content creators and the Trump administration?
Well, this administration has given special access to influencers and content creators who are politically aligned. They get ride-alongs, they get opportunities to make special content. And of course, some people within the administration came out of this world. They're influencers or online personalities themselves and are really focused on viral content. This example with Nick Shirley's Minnesota video shows how these creators can make content that reinforces broader narratives the Trump administration is already setting and can have a big impact, even when the specific facts aren't clear. Another place where we saw this happen recently was around protests at an ICE facility in Portland, where influencers' content was used to justify the Trump administration escalating its response there. I spoke more about this with Kate Starbird. She's a professor at the University of Washington, and one of the things she studies is how rumors spread online. She says these content creators can help generate so-called evidence to justify policy changes that policymakers want to do anyway, whether it's cutting social programs in Democratic states or eliminating DEI programs.
These kinds of dynamics have been very effective for the second Trump administration, leveraging these like online evidence production to support their policymaking.
One could imagine, Jude, that there are a lot of online personalities right now who are trying to replicate Nick Shirley's video.
For sure. You know, we've seen content creators filming themselves knocking on doors at other social service providing businesses in other states, including at Somali-run daycares in Ohio. Daycares there have said they're being harassed, and the Republican governor in that state has urged people to report suspected fraud, but not try to investigate it themselves. And this week, pro-Trump podcaster Benny Johnson made an announcement he's heading to California to investigate so-called massive fraud in that state. And notice that one hallmark of this kind of content is the assertion of massive fraud before the investigation or the results have come in. So be prepared to see a lot more claims and allegations floating around.
NPR's Jude Joffe Block, thanks so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It's 4:48. Thanks for listening to KAXE and All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up at 5:30, the Up North Report, local news from our region. 6 o'clock, As It Happens, news from a Canadian perspective with the CBC. And 7 o'clock tonight, a new volunteer, Isaac M., taking on the airwaves from 7 to 10 for On the River, a great mix of music. Support comes from Bemidji Brewing, located at 211 America Avenue in downtown Bemidji. Their new year starts with beer infusions and events such as Tropical Escape Week, featuring live music and tiki glassware. More at bemidjibeer.com. Bemidji Beer, nice catch. Areas of fog tonight, mostly cloudy, lows near 24 and patchy fog in the morning, partly sunny, with highs near 34 tomorrow. For Friday, mostly cloudy, highs near 29. Support for KAXE comes from North Homes Children and Family Services, providing compassionate mental health services to children and families at home, school, and in the community. More information at northhomes.org. Hibbing Public Utilities has a town hall meeting on Monday, January 12th, 6 p.m. in the Little Theater of the Hibbing Memorial Building. They will provide important information about recent lead testing results and their efforts to reduce lead exposure in the community. And you can build a cardboard sled on Tuesday, January 13th at King Elementary in Deer River, 3:30 to 5. Sleds can be used in the second annual Cardboard Classic, which is on Saturday, January 17th. Supplies will be provided. You can let us know what's happening in your community. Send us an email, psa@kaxe.org. And you can find a list of this week's events at our website. Look for Events Up North at kaxe.org. We continue now with All Things Considered.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Throughout the program today, we have been reporting on the shooting of a 37-year-old woman in Minneapolis by an Immigration and Customs Enforcement officer. We're going to turn now to Brian O'Hara. He is the police chief in Minneapolis. He's been on the scene responding to this event. He joins me now live. Welcome.
Hi. Good evening. Thank you for having me.
Hi, Chief. So the 37-year-old woman was pronounced dead at the hospital. I was watching. I saw at a news conference this afternoon. You described her as white, as not the subject of any immigration actions. Do we have that all right?
So that the information that we had preliminary at the scene remains the same, that this is a middle-aged white woman who is not the target of a pre-planned law enforcement activity, that this is a woman who was, her vehicle was blocking the roadway, and then the immigration agents got into an encounter with her. She's not the target of any pre-planned law enforcement activity.
Thank you for clarifying. What is in dispute is why she was shot. Department of Homeland Security spokeswoman Tricia McLaughlin is on record saying, and I quote, "An ICE officer fearing for his life, the lives of his fellow law enforcement, and the safety of the public fired defensive shots," end quote. Defensive shots. Was this an act, as far as you can tell, of self-defense?
Well, I think, very clearly in this country, we expect law enforcement to conduct a full and professional investigation. And that investigation should follow the evidence to its logical conclusion. Mm-hmm. While it is possible, like any other time law enforcement uses force, it's possible it could be lawful. We should allow the investigation to run its course to its logical conclusion.
So you're saying wait for the investigation. There are videos, as I'm sure you know, videos of the shooting that are circulating online. An ICE officer appears to be shooting into the front window of a moving vehicle. Have you seen these videos, Chief? What do you make of them?
I know there's several videos that are online. I have seen at least one of those videos. And I know it has been very alarming to a lot of people in the community. This is a tragedy. I think there's no ways about this. Anytime a person's life is lost, it is tragic. And certainly in law enforcement, we expect our officers to be training and trying to do everything they can to de-escalate situations. Mm-hmm. And avoid the use of force, and certainly avoid the loss of human life whenever possible.
I do want to ask just about the ICE footprint in your city. Officials in Minneapolis and state officials, the governor of Minnesota, have been weighing in. The mayor had strong words saying ICE should get out. I want to play for you. We just interviewed Minnesota Senator Tina Smith, a Democrat. She said this on our air just within the last hour.
The local law enforcement had no idea that those ICE agents were even there. And so what I see is that these agents are contributing to worsening public safety in my community rather than improving public safety.
Brian O'Hara, would you respond to that? Has ICE been helping or hindering your officers in trying to keep your city safe?
Well, it's, I responded to that scene myself very shortly after the initial call came in that there were shots fired involving law enforcement. And I saw really dozens and dozens, if not maybe a few hundred federal agents ultimately at that scene. And so, you know, the thing that I have been concerned about this entire time, again, is not so much whether or not federal law enforcement is happening, but truly the manner, how this enforcement action is being conducted. We should be doing everything in our power to ensure our professional responsibility. Okay. And that is that we are paying attention to the manner in which our officers are performing enforcement actions on the
Brian
street.
Brian O'Hara.
I think that's a professional responsibility.
Thank you so much. Brian O'Hara is Minneapolis Police Chief. Thank you.
Holiday songs have finally disappeared from the Billboard charts, paving the way for old and new faces on the Hot 100. And Stephen Thompson of NPR Music has been listening.
Last week, 46 of the top 50 songs in America were about the holidays. This week, a cleansing fire sweeps across the charts as Mariah Carey and Michael Bublé get packed in mothballs and return to the attic whence they came. That means massive upheaval on this week's chart as last fall's sturdiest hits return more or less to where they left off.
I heard you calling on the megaphone. You want to see me all.
Taking me out of the ordinary. I want you laying me down.
In other words, the pop charts in 2026 don't look all that different from the pop charts in 2025, before the holidays flooded the Hot 100 with a plague of good cheer. But there are other beneficiaries of life after the holidays. This week, the country singer Ella Langley lands her first ever top 10 hit as her song Choosin' Texas zooms all the way up to number 5.
She's from Texas, I can tell by the way he's two-stepping round the room. And judging by the smile that's written on his face, there's nothing I can do.
The Grammy-nominated R&B star Olivia Dean posts the biggest numbers of her young career. She has 6 songs on the Hot 100, led by Man I Need at number 4. One other chart surge worth noting belongs to an older song. The Netflix drama Stranger Things has been rolling out its final episodes in the past few weeks, and as anyone who's followed the show knows, it's been a major driver of chart success for songs from the 1980s, like Kate Bush's Running Up That Hill. This week, Stranger Things helps drive a different older song back onto the charts, End of Beginning by the band Joe. The lead singer of Joe just happens to be Joe Keery, who plays Steve Harrington on Stranger Things. This week, fueled by interest in Stranger Things and the fate of Steve Harrington, the 2022 song End of Beginning re-enters the Billboard Hot 100 at number 16. Stephen Thompson, NPR Music.
And you're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Workday. Workday is an AI platform for forward thinkers dedicated to transforming the way business leaders manage people, money, and agents today so they can transform tomorrow. Workday, moving business forever forward. From the Lemelson Foundation, working to harness the power of invention and innovation to accelerate climate action and improve lives around the world. Learn more at lemelson.org. And from the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity, regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org. This is NPR.
It is a minute before 5 o'clock. Thank you for listening to 91.7 KAXC Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXC Bagley, Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker. We're people-powered radio in northern Minnesota. We invite you to join us at KAXC.org. I'm Jennifer Barr. Stay tuned for another hour of All Things Considered, including the Up North Report, local news from our region at 5:30. 6 o'clock, as it happens, news from a Canadian perspective, and 7 o'clock tonight, Isaac M., your volunteer host for On the River, bringing you a great mix of music. Bemidji Community Theater has auditions for The Sword in the Stone tonight and tomorrow from 5 to 7 each evening. Roles are available for ages 8 through 80 plus. Be